In a culture obsessed with accumulation, achievement, and consumer comfort, it's easy to get swept into the endless drive for more. But what if that pursuit is actually keeping us from the life God wants for us? This five-week series at Sycamore Creek Church explores how Jesus invites us to be free from the love of money and free for a life of purpose, generosity, and joy. You'll uncover spiritual practices and countercultural truths that help you step off the treadmill and into a posture of gratitude and stewardship. Whether you're living paycheck to paycheck or sitting on a surplus, God's desire is the same: freedom.
Have you ever seen the show Hoarders? I've not ever seen it, and I gotta be honest, I have some issues with the show, but it's part of our culture, right, that I was reminded of in preparing this message. Here's the trailer for season 11 of Hoarders.
It's critical. It's life or death at this point.
These are real people.
I just can't get a grip on it.
Buried by the weight of their things.
He's just overwhelmed. He doesn't know what else to do.
This could be anybody.
We're here to help you.
I love you, and I don't want to see you live like this.
We're here for you. We're going to get this done.
You're not living a life. You're just living life. This is your chance to get out.
And part of why I struggle with the show Hoarders is that it focuses on people who are, they're really struggling. You know, this isn't like having three or four cats. This is like 300 cats that people hoard. And this is way beyond normal accumulation. And well, the show at times can feel a bit exploitative and like we're supposed to watch and like just sit there with our popcorn judging the people on the show. Now, hoarding is a really tough problem. And the DSM, that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, published by the American Psychiatric Association, it classifies hoarding as a mental health disorder. If you've seen the show at all, well, you'll understand why. Now, part of why I'm mentioning the show is because hoarding isn't just about hoarding. Hoarding causes tremendous problems, both for the hoarder and for anyone caught in their wake. And there's all sorts of hurt and harm that can lead to hoarding. And I haven't watched this show because, well, I feel tremendous compassion for the people on the show. They're constantly battling things like health issues and evictions and children being taken away and spouses filing for divorce, even physical injury, all connected to hoarding. Hoarding is an illness and it has huge impacts on other areas of life. If we see someone who hoards 200 chickens in their apartment, we think they have a problem, right? So here's my question today. Why don't we look at people who hoard wealth as having a problem? Why are hoarders of money often applauded by us while hoarders of newspapers are judged and condemned? We live in a culture where consumption and greed are not just tolerated, they are often celebrated. Beyond even the extremes we see on hoarders, the constant pressure to hoard and to consume more and more and more is causing tremendous problems in our world. The culture of consumption is killing us. And if we do not choose to intentionally live differently than the culture around us and to resist the hoarding that often goes with it, well, we'll never be free to experience the fullness of life that Jesus wants for us. Today, we're continuing in our series, Free Money, or more fully, Free from the Love of Money. Now, this series is based on content from Zach Lambert, the pastor of a church in Texas called Restore Austin. And this series, Free from the Love of Money, is about principles and practices to help set us free from consumerism, materialism, and greed. We're also wrapping up our deep dive into Jesus' most famous sermon, the Sermon on the Mount, found in Matthew 5 through 7. Now, Jesus talked about money a lot. And he said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust consume and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust consumes and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Let's pause here for a chat question. As we get into freedom today, freedom from the love of money, I started by introducing you to hoarders, and there's so much there. And again, my primary response to hoarding is compassion for all the reasons that we might potentially head to hoarding, and also a desire that we'd all find something better You see, hoarding is a temptation for all of us. And if we're not careful, the destructive nature of hoarding can take over any one of our lives. So here's our question for discussion. As you consider hoarding, what comes to mind about why and how we accumulate things? Let's take a minute. Let's talk about that. So far in Free From the Love of Money, we've covered two core principles. Principle one, it's not just money. The Bible talks about this all over the place. Jesus even personifies money as a spiritual power, mammon, that we're often tempted to place our trust in rather than God. It's not just money. Principle two is that we don't own anything. The Bible is also clear from beginning to end that God is the owner and creator and sustainer of all things. Anything that we have is on loan from God. We're stewards of it, managers of it. We are not owners of anything. So those are the first two principles that we have covered. And as we approach our first practice today, I want to remind us a little bit that having money, a little bit of it or a lot of it, it isn't inherently bad or sinful, but our posture toward money is vitally important. What we do with the wealth and possessions that God has given us to steward is what matters most, whether we have a little or whether we have a lot. What we do with our money matters. With that in mind, here's our first practice. Practice one is only take what you need. Only take what you need. The Bible has a great story about this practice that would have made a perfect episode for hoarders. It's found in Luke's account of Jesus' life. In Luke, Jesus tells this parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, "What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops." And he said, "This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store my surplus grain. And I will say to myself, 'You have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself?' This is how it will be for whoever stores up or hoards things for themselves, but is not rich toward God." The man in this story stored up or hoarded things for himself. He wasn't rich toward God. He tore down perfectly good barns and built bigger ones just so he could keep more and more of his stuff. Now we hear this story from Jesus, and well, it seems foolish of the man, right? And so obvious. Who would do something like that? Well, the rich fool may have invented building bigger barns to hold all this stuff, but Americans, well, we have perfected it. Do you know that there are more than 50,000 storage facilities? Again, that's not individual units, that's storage facilities or complexes for storage in the United States. Now, just for comparison's sake, there's about 14,000 McDonald's franchises in the United States. 14,000 McDonald's franchises compared to 50,000 storage unit facilities. The annual revenue of these storage facilities is $44.3 billion, that's billion with a B, annually. And again, for comparison, McDonald's annual revenue is about $26 billion. Dismiss the rich fool all you want, but here in the USA, we've taken hoarding to a whole new level. Just like the man in Jesus' story, our culture teaches us to believe that if we can just store up enough, we'll finally be satisfied. But it's never enough, no matter how much we get. The cycle of acquisition and consumption and acquisition and consumption never stops. Now, hoarding is based on a concept called scarcity. Scarcity is a belief that, you know, we'll never have enough and we must do everything we can to get more and more and more. And there are legit reasons we might have a scarcity mentality. A scarcity mindset, which is all around us though, it's toxic. It's poisoning you. It's poisoning me. It's poisoning many areas of our society. See, scarcity involves the end of getting more, always justifying the means of how we get more. Let me repeat that. Scarcity involves the end of getting more, always justifying the means of how we get more. And as I said earlier, hoarding doesn't just hurt the hoarder. It hurts everyone caught in its wake as well. And while hoarding may lead to great earthly wealth for some, it leads to poverty and to oppression for others. Because when someone gives into the scarcity mindset, it always ends up leaving other people without their basic needs met. If you're struggling to have your basic needs met today, it's because someone else is hoarding. Now I want to share with you a hoarding story about hoarding here in the United States. It starts with the Federal Housing Administration, or the FHA for short. The FHA was established after the passage of something called the National Housing Act of 1934. This act was part of the New Deal under FDR, and it was passed during the Great Depression to make housing and home mortgages more affordable for Americans. Well, for some Americans, at least. In 1935, the FHA asked the Homeowners Loan Corporation, or HOLC, to survey 239 U.S. cities and create something called, quote, residential security maps. Now, these maps would help predict where the federal loans would have the greatest return on investment. The idea was that if the government was going to put money into a community through this New Deal program, the HOLC would predict where they were going to have the best chances of getting the most back. But the HOLC, it didn't just predict. It actively influenced the outcomes through a process called redlining. Now, if any of you have done anything with anti-racism work, you've probably heard about this process of redlining. Redlining was a practice employed by the FHA, which separated 239 U.S. cities into four zones through a grading system. So green stood for best, blue stood for still desirable, yellow stood for definitely declining, and red stood for hazardous. Now, the vast majority of neighborhoods receiving the declining and hazardous red grades were made up of racial minorities, mostly Black and Latino, while the communities receiving the still desirable or best grades were almost always exclusively white. One of the 239 cities that was redlined was Lansing, Michigan. Richmond University in Virginia has compiled all the original residential security maps through a project called Mapping Inequality. And they turned them into this amazing interactive website. You can Google it, Mapping Inequality, and find it. It's really incredible. I'm serious. Check it out. Through that project, we have a picture of the Lansing map. That's a scan of the original red line map for the Lansing area. And you can see the different parts of Lansing by grade. Look for the green areas, and you'll find historically wealthy and white communities in Lansing. Look at the red areas, and those are the historically Black communities in Lansing. Now, let me be clear. It wasn't just that these federally redlined areas didn't get any funding. These maps, just like the one I showed you, became the FHA standards for any kind of loans, not just home mortgages. That meant lenders couldn't get FHA insurance on their loans if they invested in redlined communities in any way. And for decades, this led to both public and private entities denying loans for individuals, businesses, and even nonprofits in Black and Latino neighborhoods. Now you might be thinking, hold on, Mark. How do you know that this redlining was about race? Maybe all those low grades were given to communities of color and it's just a big coincidence. And here's the thing, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a coincidence. The bottom line is that the policies of the FHA and of our government disadvantaged Black and Latino neighborhoods. From 1934 to 1962, a time when many white families, including my own grandparents, were purchasing homes and building wealth, $120 billion of new housing was subsidized by the government. Do you know how much of the housing subsidies went to non-white Americans? Less than 2%. Less than 2%. But here's the thing. This wasn't a coincidence. The FHA appraisal manuals distributed during these times, they all came with maps with specific instructions for banks to stay away from redlined areas because they were, quote, filled with inharmonious racial groups. those are government issued instructions. This practice of denying loans to people based on their race continued for decades and was not made illegal until 1974, by the Credit Opportunity Act. Instead of looking out for folks suffering through the Great Depression and thinking, how can we uplift all Americans? The federal government thought, how can we help people who look like us and make sure we get the most money possible? So at the height of segregation and Jim Crow, an all-white federal government decided to only give money to white families and white communities, believing that would yield them the most money back. They told the banks, they told other lending organizations to not give out loans for houses or businesses to people in communities of color. Now, again, you might be thinking, well, Mark, how do you know the people making the decisions at the federal level were white? Well, this is a really easy one to answer because we have history books and records, and the race and ethnicity of every cabinet member is listed in those history books. The first Black cabinet member took office in 1966. The first Latino cabinet member took office in 1988. 1988. I was 10 years old then. The Great Depression was horrific. Most historians and economic experts agree that the New Deal was vital for lifting us out of it. But who is us? Because although many Americans greatly benefited from the New Deal and our nationwide economic health indicators went up, racial minorities in our country were largely excluded from it. And this action remains. These actions remain one of the most egregious examples of hoarding in our country's history. And we're still feeling the effects of it today. This hoarding based on race and class has led to massive wealth gaps, which are getting worse today. For instance, in 2016, due to the ongoing devaluation of property in historically redlined areas, predominantly white school districts received $23 billion more in state and local funding than predominantly non-white school districts. That's almost $2,000 more per student. That's directly saying that this white student is worth $2,000 more a year than this student of color. I could go on and on about economic impacts in our country, but I'm going to end with this one final example. The median wealth level for a white family with kids in the United States is $291,901. For a Latino family with kids, it's $45,900. For a Black family with kids, it's $20,970. Let me be really clear. None of these statistics are caused by the inferiority of a particular race or ethnicity. Racial wealth gaps exist because of practices and policies of hoarding. Hoarding. That is why they exist. And we should all care about this because, again, hoarding hurts everyone. I'm going to give you a moment to process and to digest this example of hoarding. So here's our next question for discussion. What is your response to hearing about the practices and policies of hoarding here in the United States? Let's take a moment and let's wrestle with that together. I think we should all care about this. But if you are a follower of Jesus, you should really, really, really care about this. Because God is generous, and hoarding is the opposite of generous. And from the opening pages of Genesis to the end of Revelation and everywhere in between, God calls us to only take what we need and to give any extra we don't need to the people who don't have enough. That's generous. And as they made their way to the promised land, God gave the Israelite people enough manna for just one day at a time. And God told them, do not take more than you need. Do not hoard. And when people tried to hoard up the manna, well, the next morning they found it eaten with maggots and gross stuff. God essentially says this again and again, take only what you need. The author of the wisdom book of the Bible, Proverbs, prayed, give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me just enough to satisfy my needs. When Jesus taught us to pray, he told us to ask God to provide our daily bread. No more, no less. In Hebrews, the early followers of Jesus were instructed to keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. Again and again in the Bible, the message from God is clear. God is generous, and hoarding is the opposite of generous. When someone takes more than they need, when someone hoards, others are left with not enough. When one person hoards, another person goes without. Scripture speaks to this universal truth. In Ecclesiastes, it says, "Don't be surprised if you see a poor person being oppressed by the powerful, and if justice is being miscarried throughout the land. For every official is under orders from higher up, and matters of justice get lost in the red tape and bureaucracy. Even the king milks the land for his own profit. Those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness." That passage was written thousands of years ago, and yet it's tragically relevant for us today. That paragraph could have easily been written about redlining in America or about a myriad of other greed-induced oppressive practices fueled by hoarding, fueled by a scarcity mindset. And the problem is that scarcity is a lie. There's plenty to go around. If we would only stop hoarding resources and start sharing with others, we will find that there is enough for everyone. We've made the grave mistake of believing that the answer to scarcity is affluence. We believe that the answer to scarcity is more and more and more for me. But it's not. The opposite of scarcity isn't affluence. The opposite of scarcity is enough. It's enough. By now, I hope that you're convinced of a few truths. That God is generous, and hoarding is the opposite of generous. That hoarding hurts everyone, the hoarder and the people all around caught in its wake. And that we are called by God to only take what we need. Throughout the entirety of Scripture, God's people are called to only take what we need and to give any extra we have to people who don't have enough. I'm trying to be super clear here because we must intentionally move away from the consumeristic society in which we live. If we don't actively choose to only take what we need, our natural bent toward consumption in this materialistic world will eat up every last resource God has given us to steward. We need to be intentional about only taking what we need. So how do we do that? How do we only take what we need? Well, first, we must be honest with ourselves. We must be honest about our tendency to hoard and to consume. Because here's the thing, hoarding isn't always extravagant or wasteful. It's not as extreme as on hoarders. And this is a tough bit of truth to swallow. But hoarding isn't always in big, huge, over-the-top ways. Sometimes we hoard under the guise of building security or investing in the future or being really good at saving money. All of those things can be hoarding. Now, I'm all for saving money. I'm all for investing in the future. But there is a fine line between doing that in a healthy way and being the rich fool, believing that the security that you are storing up by your hoarding is going to lead to you and your children's children to have happiness and contentment because you got enough money to give them. It's simply not where hope and happiness are found. So we must sincerely ask and answer this question for ourselves. Do I have more than I need? And for most of us, the answer is an unequivocal yes, because most of us have extra. Now, here's an extra test. Let's see how we do. If you've ever looked at a drawer or a closet of clothes and thought, I have nothing to wear, you have extra. If you've ever paid anything for entertainment in the last year, Netflix, concerts, movies, anything, you have extra. If you have ever upgraded, and by that I mean you've taken something that works, a phone, a car, an apartment, a television, and upgraded to something else that works, you have extra. If you ever spend more than $2 on a cup of coffee, you have extra. If you've ever gotten an Amazon package that you ordered and you don't know what's in it, you have extra. And I'll tell you, this is me. I am right here with you. I have extra. We have extra. Most of us have extra. And the point here is not how much extra, it's what we do with the extra that we have. You see, we assume that our extra is for us. It's to hoard and to consume. That's what the world tells us. And there's a part of us that is always going to want more. Now, we don't like what I'm saying right now, do we? I don't like what I'm saying right now. We like to say that the extra we have is ours. It's ours to spend and to save because that makes us feel better about it. And what we're really saying is that our extra is for us to hoard and to consume. It is for me. I want it. But what would happen if we began to see our extra as an opportunity to help those who don't have enough? What if we saw our extra as something given to us by God to give to others? Everything would change. And not just for the person who receives, but for the person who gives. You know, let's pause to reflect on this because this is challenging stuff. Here's our next question for discussion. Do you think that you have extra? And if you do, how would it change your view of that extra to look for ways to help those who don't have enough? Let's take a moment and let's discuss that together. Now, not everyone is called to sell everything they have and give all the money to the poor like Jesus told the rich young ruler to do. And if you remember that story from the Bible, the story is descriptive of a particular event. And I don't think it's prescriptive. It's not what everyone is supposed to do. This call from God to only take what we need and use the rest to help others, we are all called to that, but it's going to look different for different people. And it's going to look different for me than it is going to look for you. But it does require some self-examination and some spending examination. Now, I want to introduce you to Ann Patchett. For her, changing her relationship with money and stuff looked like not shopping for 12 months. So back in 2017, Anne wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times called My Year of No Shopping. And in it, she talked about her growing disdain for a materialistic culture and how she decided to spend a year not buying anything she didn't absolutely need. She came up with her own set of rules for the year. So she bought grocery items, toiletries, batteries, you know, other things that are consumables, but only after she had completely run out of them. And this was a practice Anne used to evaluate her consuming and her spending. It's a practice that points to our own need to evaluate our consuming and our spending. So at one point in her year, Anne ran out of lip balm. And she talks about how she decided to look for more before she bought more. She looked through her desk drawers and through her coat pockets, and she found 5 tubes. She did the same thing with lotion and with soap and with hair products, finding enough of them under her sink and in other places to last 3 years. This is shopping in your own home from what you already have. And as Anne reflected on her year without consumption in this article, she said, "Once I could see what I already had and what actually mattered, I was left with a feeling that was somewhere between sickened and humbled. When did I amass so many things and did someone else need them?" Now, Anne acknowledges that not shopping for a year hardly made her one with the poor. What Anne did is not going to work for everyone or really solve anything, but it did help open her eyes to how she could help others with her extra. She concluded, "If you stop thinking about what you might want, it's a whole lot easier to see what other people don't have. Once I was able to get past the want and be honest about the need, it was easier to give more of my money to people who could really use it." Anne is pointing us toward practices, like looking over what we already have before buying more, that help increase satisfaction with what we have. Like Anne, if we are able to get past the want and be honest about what we really require to live, what we really need, it becomes so much easier to use our extra to help people who don't have enough. Now, this is obviously going to help the people who've been hurt by oppressive hoarding practices. But listen to me, it's going to help you too. It's going to help you too. Because listen to what Jesus says right before he tells the story of the rich fool. This is for me and this is for you. Jesus said to them, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. There is no life in wealth and possessions. There is no life in the endless cycle of accumulation and consumption. There is no life in having the nicest car, the latest phone, or storage units filled with extra stuff. There's no life in it. And we all know this. And yet so many of us spend our entire lives pursuing more and more and more. If we're not careful and intentional about how we use our resources, the internal and external pressure of consumption, it's going to win out. If we don't make intentional choices, the choices to consume and to acquire and to hoard will be made for us. So here's my final question for us today. Do you want abundance of possessions? Or do you want an abundant life? Jesus was clear. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. We cannot pursue an abundance of possessions and experience an abundant life. We cannot serve both God and money. God is generous, and hoarding is the opposite of generous. Hoarding hurts everyone. We are called by God to only take what we need. So let's do it. Let's stop hoarding and consuming our extra because it only hurts us and our neighbors. Let's only take what we need. And let's give any extra we have to folks who don't have enough. We belong to each other. Let's do this together. Amen.